Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 58 of Histories of the Unexpected, where we will be audio googling through history, exploring the history of things you didn't even know had a significant story to tell, like courage, cages, and castration.
Or cars, bars, and jars, spoons, moons, and pontoons, blood, mud, and floods. Out of those, which do you want to do?
I would like to do the unexpected history of floods.
Floods.
Yeah, which obviously would not be just about there were a flood happened here, no, and a flood happened there. It's about
floods of tears, floods of.
I'd like to do
flooded
floods
kitchens
and castration
and Ooh, that sounds eunuchs. Very good. I like that. And we'll be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how simply everything has a history and, crucially, how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, who knew that the history of dance is all about political codes? It's about celebration, it's about magic, and it's about rain.
And ceilings. Did you know that?
Ceilings. Dancing on the ceiling, yes.
Oh, no. Noisy
neighbours.
No, it's so to do with ballrooms, isn't it? It's to do with ballrooms and architecture. And decorating ceilings.
Very good.
And Versailles, among other things. Anyway.
Johnsonian masks and the history of trees. The history of trees is about landscape tunnels, naval battles, memorialisation, paper, and the most horrific wounds.
Oh, okay.
Firing troops hiding in trees and being shot at, and the splinters of the trees just sort of...
Yeah, gosh.
Going. Yes.
The man sitting opposite me is the Yeti of yesterday. It's Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell.
And hello. And sticking with my religious theme, the man sitting opposite me is the pastor of past times. It's the famous historical adventurer, the truly wonderful Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, everyone. And every week we take it in turns to discuss a unexpected subject oozing with historical significance. Now, we're in the middle of doing a kind of a mini-series on writing and books, aren't we? Because we're writing a book.
We are writing a book. We are writing a book, and we've been plugging this for every single podcast that we've been doing. But we're writing a book on the histories of the unexpected for
Yay!
You, which will be in bookshops and online by probably October 2018, ready
Absolutely.
For Christmas.
And so one of the things we thought we'd do, we've done the history of the book, we've done the history of writing, we've done the history of papers, blah, blah, blah.
Codes.
We are doing the history of our books.
We are.
Which is kind of an interesting thing. A, that our books have their own history, of course they do, but that it's something that we can map and we can talk about, actually. We can talk about the sort of the historical process of writing the books, how that changed, and the kind of the physical appearance of the books.
Yes, nice.
Who wants to go first? I've got more than you.
Yeah. I've brought 8 with me.
Oh, that's good.
Yes.
Okay. This could be a long...
They're books that took a long... I'm older than you. I've been writing for longer.
Yeah.
I am older
Let's
than you.
Let's start at the beginning.
Let's
good
start
historians.
At the beginning.
What's the first one? Show me your first one.
My first book, if I can find it. Maybe I haven't brought it. Yeah, here it is. So, Oxford University Press, and it's Women Letter Writers in Tudor England,
pass.
Which is a brilliant, brilliant book.
Now, as a rule,
do say so
I
myself.
Always judge a book by its cover.
Yes, it's nice, isn't it?
As you should. Oxford University Press, so that's a very good publishing house for your first book, James.
It is.
Women Letter Writers in Tudor England, James Daybell. It's beautiful, actually. It's very dark. Who's this on the front cover?
She's a lady letter writer, a female letter writer. Unknown woman, but a portrait in the National, from the National Gallery, I think.
Let me read the blurb. The most comprehensive study of women's letters and letter writing during the early modern period so far undertaken. Women letter writers in Tudor England act as an important corrective to traditional ways of reading and discussing letters as private, elite, male and non-political. Based on over 3,000 manuscript letters. Gosh, did you read them all?
Yes. Transcribed them all.
The book reveals how letter writing was a larger and more socially diversified area of female activity in the 16th century than has previously been assumed.
I wrote that myself. That's not puff.
Okay.
No. You pen your own blurbs. Yes. And it's the extraordinary price of about £60, £65.
Wow, that's interesting. It's a collector's item.
And this was basically the book of my PhD. So it's very, very common for people who want to make an academic career, having done your PhD, to try and turn it into a book. I mean, it took me another 6 years to write.
Let me jump in here, because my first book is based on my PhD. So do you want to grab that one there?
Which one?
Third down. Yeah. Oh. We'll do the same thing, and then we'll just talk about the history of our books in terms of writing our first books.
Yes, great.
You can read the blurb.
Okay, so this is another handsome book with ships on the front, ships at battle. It's titled Fighting at Sea in the 18th Century, The Art of Sailing Warfare by Sam Willis. And the publisher is Boyd Ellen Brewer, another excellent academic press. Did you pen this blurb yourself?
Don't think so.
The history of warfare between sailing warships has long been divorced from the practicalities of seamanship and the harsh reality of battle. For generations, the skills required to fight have been poorly understood, based upon new and original research, which is obviously very important. This book explains in greater detail than ever before how and why sea fights were won and lost in the age of sail. What strikes me about both of these blurbs is what we're trying to do, because these are academic books,
yes.
You are trying to insert it in a field. You are trying to trumpet why, basically, so what? Yeah, why is this book important?
It's not just an interesting book, it's important, and it says new stuff.
Yeah.
And so these books, it's interesting, they're both the same size. I mean, there must be 80,000 words?
Yeah, 100? This is probably about 100.
How many pages? I've got 254.
Words. I have 328.
328.
Okay. I think I got away with... I got away with more words than I should have done.
So it's interesting. For us, the history of our books, the unexpected history of our books, it takes us back to being, I suppose, 24?
Yeah.
About 24 or 25. And to get onto the ladder of writing, we turned our PhDs into books.
Yes.
Did you study your PhD with a book in mind? Did you deliberately choose it because you thought you could turn it into a book?
Probably. I mean, I think the thing is that when you're embarking upon an academic career nowadays, you can't but think in that way. Mm. And I was actually incredibly hard-headed and practical about how I chose things. And I chose this because I thought that it would be an entry into the field. I sat down when I started on my PhD. I didn't really know exactly what I was going to do. I'd got funding and I had about three different projects. I was going to do something on Thomas Cromwell's political patronage. And I kind of thought, you know, this would be great. But I'd be then sort of sparring with the great and the good in early Tudor history. So he's famously 1530s leading statesman in the reign of Henry VIII. Geoffrey Elton and David Starkey and, you know, goodness knows who had already written on him. I was going to do that, or I was going to do something on women and politics in early Tudor England, but somebody else, a good friend of mine, Barbara Harris, had already, you know, had filled that place in the field. I was also then going to do something on mid-Tudor households and women. And then I sat down with my supervisor and he said, well, why don't you do something on women's letters? He said, you know, this is something that nobody has done anything on.
Yeah.
So you immediately...
It's unbelievable. You no one has done anything on it.
I mean, there are bits, there are, you know, odd little bits and pieces.
But not a substantial book.
But not a substantial book. And this was intended to be the kind of comprehensive study, and it is the kind of, it's the go-to study now.
Did you enjoy
for people working, you know, for you, working in that area?
Did you enjoy writing it?
Yes, loved it. I think though I haven't always found writing as enjoyable. I think I enjoy it much more now.
Yeah.
And I think as I get older and I get more experienced and I move further away from the PhD stage. The PhD is an extraordinary beast. Because you are having to jump through hoops. You have a supervisor who, I had a wonderful supervisor in Ralph Holbrook, great sort of social and religious historian, a truly great historian. He was very, very supportive, but nonetheless, you know, he has a professional role to, you know, bring you on as a historian and train you. And so you are constantly writing and somebody is critiquing what you are writing.
Yeah. And you have to do it with certain types of language. And
yes,
do it
exactly.
Certain sort of things.
And also, I think we are very, we are very different historians. And I think, you know, we both accept that. And I think
we both had to turn our PhDs into books.
Yes.
You can't just copy and paste it. You have to rewrite
the
whole thing. Make it acceptable.
Absolutely.
Easily, easily digestible.
Yes.
But even though it's for an academic, you've written an academic book for an academic audience, you have to make it more widely digestible than just your examiner. Don't
yes.
You?
Mm. But I wrote for a long time with him on my shoulder. Mm. So him as my audience. And I found that, you know, that was great because what it did, he's utterly forensic in the way in which he reads. And so you write kind of almost trying to inoculate yourself against, you know, every critique that's going to come at you. The problem is, stylistically, that imposes certain constraints on you. And I found as I've moved away from that period, I've been able to be much freer with how I write.
Yeah. So I think the interesting thing is that I did the same. My supervisor was Professor Nicholas Roger, who's was a fabulous man. He's not dead. But he was wonderful to me during the process of writing it. But I think what's interesting here is that the history of our books both begins with an audience of one.
Yes. Yes.
And then it dramatically changes.
Yes.
And it moves on and it moves up. So I think what's also fascinating now is that our careers split at this stage.
Yes.
And so I'm going to show you.
I want to hear more about writing these books, about how you actually wrote about it. Can we come back to that?
We can definitely come back to that. And I think this history of the mapping of our writing is something I want to explore. So after this, I then wrote those three enormous books down there, which are the Fighting Ships.
Goodness me.
Fighting Ships books.
Are those A3 size?
I don't know what they are. They're massive.
They're enormous books.
Bigger than sort of Atlas size is what they are. And so we've done Fighting Ships from the Ancient World to 1750, Fighting Ships 1750 to 1850, and Fighting Ships 1850 to 1950. And what they allowed me to do, this is when there was a kind of a revolution in print technology in China. And you can start producing books like this. I mean, they're enormous and they're full colour.
Yeah.
You could start producing books like this in colour and selling them for 20 quid. Yeah. So in like the 1990s...
They were 20 quid?
Yeah. In the 1990s, they'd be 150 quid.
Yes.
Actually mass produce and mass sell enormous books.
Yes.
And no one had done it before. And it allowed me to... it's still sort of hanging on to the academic side of things in terms of discovering and presenting new material to the public. There's a lot of great new material there. Ship plans, images, battle plans, portraits, all sorts of things. But every spread is focused on one image or a collection of images with a little bit of like a paragraph blurb about it. So that's what I moved on to.
Big, visually stunning books, very different from a kind of what we've been talking about with our first books is these are research monographs.
Yeah.
So monographs being a single authored academic book that is an intervention within the field. These are, you know, big, visually stunning books.
Yeah, but for a much, much broader market. They also still, you know, present new information. I mean, you said you wanted to know more about the process of writing this first book. Ask me some questions. What do you mean particularly?
What do I mean? Well, I think you could take this from several ways. One is how you came up with the initial idea to do this as a PhD, I suppose. That's where it started. How you went out and did the primary research. Mm. How you then came up with the structure of the book.
Yep.
How you then, I mean, the interesting thing then is how you turn a PhD, really detailed but narrow PhD, into a book that people are going to...
Yeah.
Again, so the problem nowadays for PhD students is that their PhDs are automatically put on electronic repositories
right.
in universities and at the British Library on Ethos. Any of you wanting to read recent history PhDs can do so for free through the British Library on their Ethos system, E-T-H-O-S. And the problem is that historians wanting a career have to sort of then persuade publishers that what they're writing for their first book is markedly different from the PhD.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's a lot of the otherwise, same material.
Why would somebody buy it?
Yeah. What immediately struck me when I was studying naval history early on, before I did my PhD, is that I was interested in naval tactics. I was interested in how ships actually worked, basically, and the relationship between that and our given understanding of naval tactics, and they were markedly different. In fact, all of our understanding of naval tactics had been based on books which were essentially written by mathematicians in the 17th century, and French-Dutch kind of treatises, mainly. And they saw the problem of sailing ships as a geometrical, mathematical problem. Mm. And it meant that all of the writing about tactics was theoretical. It was kind of pie-in-the-sky stuff. And so I realized that if you went to a different load of sources, whether it's descriptions of battles, logbooks, and particularly court-martial records. Yep. They're wonderful because they don't just tell you what happened. They ask why it happened. Mm. And they don't just explain why it happened. They ask the captain, different sailors, different officers. So they ask the same question to 10 or 15 people.
Yeah.
So you get a different perspective on what's happening. Once I'd kind of narrowed that down, I realized I could completely rewrite our understanding of how sailing warships fought in battle.
Yeah.
And then by doing that, you can rewrite how and why we won battles.
Yeah.
And that changes our understanding of how and why we might have won wars. And then suddenly, you know, you basically just you put a crack in the foundations of so much.
Mm-hmm.
And so the implications of what I'd actually done were huge.
Yeah.
And it made it, you know, it required reading for all naval historians of the period.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doing the actual structure of the book was really interesting. So my chapters are contact. It's basically like being in a battle.
Yeah.
First contact, before the ships fight each other. Mm. How can you identify the other ship as an enemy? Or even if the other ship is hostile, how can you identify the nationality of the other ship? So it's all to do with identification and intention through behavior of ships. Chase and escape. So what you're going to do, you're going to run away, you're going to escape. How you actually did that. And then a separate chapter on the tactics of chasing. So speed and performance, tactics of chasing. Then something on station keeping. So people just talked about ships working in fleets, but how do they actually do it? And what implications did that have for command and control? Communication, this is really interesting. So it's the communication between ships.
Mm.
And a lot of the history here had been written about flags and signaling codes. But what I managed to demonstrate is there were such big gaps in the commands and signaling code that didn't tell you what you needed to know. There was also a huge body of unwritten rules of expected behavior. And one of the things that really got me thinking about this was looking at the court's martial records, and people were defending what they did according to the expected way of doing things, as is expected, according to the custom of the day. And I suddenly realized there was an entire body of knowledge that we didn't know anything about.
Yeah.
So I had a whole chapter on unwritten rules, which is probably the thing I'm most proud about,
right,
when I suddenly realized that there was something that we were missing.
Hmm.
All to do, then command, how you actually commanded, fleet tactics, fighting tactics, repairing damage, position in relation to the wind, and then a conclusion. The repairing damage was good as well. So I found out the different ways that sailors repair damage, and there's a whole kind of a hidden area of seamanship there, which we didn't know anything about. And actually, the really interesting story is not about how many ships were lost or sunk, and this applies to shipwreck as well, in battle or in storm. You're looking at the negative. It's how many ships were nearly lost or sunk but saved. that's actually the most interesting point. And there's a whole kind of world of human skill which has been utterly lost. And once you understand it, it kind of reshapes your understanding of the maritime world, basically.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, my book came to me on... I had this sort of... To go back to what I was saying earlier on, I had this sort of conundrum of what to do. And then my supervisor had sort of said, go away and write, spend the next term writing, reports on... on these three different topics. And I thought, oh God, that's going to take, it's going to be such a waste of my time. I went away to visit my sister at university. She was at university in Wales, and I went on a long train journey, and I just sat down and thought, and then came and just sort of said, right, that's what I need to do. Picked the thing on women's letter writing. And then the first thing that I did was, having decided on it, I basically just needed to go out and find the material.
Yeah.
So I started with a massive trawl through the archives. I went through, and there was a little book called Record Offices and How to Find Them. And I got a list of every record office and repository in the United Kingdom and also in North America. And I wrote letters to them. Mm-hmm. And I said, have you got, women's letters from... And I cast my net very wide, from 1400 to 1800, and I got back like a foot of mail from them. I've still got it. It's one of the, and haven't gone through, haven't followed up on half of it because it's so much material. So I then found all this material. I then spent a year traveling around the country, visiting record offices up and down the country, finding this material. This was before digital cameras. So I wasn't sort of nowadays you'd go and you'd snap and go, and it's this kind of smash and grab kind of archival trawl. But you'd basically have to physically sit in these libraries and make transcripts.
Yeah.
I had to learn paleography. So I had to learn the history of handwriting. I had to learn how to read them. And then what you've got to do is impose. So rather like your structure that you're talking about, impose some kind of structure on this. And this is the, if we go through the chapters of my book. So you start off with the introduction where you make your argument, you talk about sources, you talk about methodology in terms of like how are you going to read these things. You talk about the field, the historiography. So the historiography basically means the history of the subject. So how do you insert it into different sort of fields? So I set that all up.
Who's written what about it before? Yeah.
Then there's a chapter on letters and letter writers. So basically this went through, who are these women? What social class are they from? What age are they? So all the sort of fundamentals. And then, letters are not just simple documents. You then unpack, what kinds of letters are they? What are they writing about? All of those sort of topics and themes. And then one of the things that struck me was, how they were written.
Yeah.
So I looked at the composition of letters. So people write, and we've talked a lot about this in the past, the use of secretaries, the use of models, templates, dictation. Then I considered it in the next chapter in terms of female literacy and the social conventions of writing. So this was basically, you know, thinking about it in terms of women's education and the rules, the unwritten rules, rather like your unwritten rules, the unwritten rules of when you would write yourself and when you wouldn't. Then in the fifth chapter, I considered delivery. So, you know, letters are not just sort of simple documents that we read as historians, but they need to be delivered. It's about postal conditions. They then need to be read. So I was considering, you know, I was considering those kinds of things. Yeah. Then the functions of letters. So looking at the roles that they play, the uses of them. And then it all, the next chapter looked at social relations, you know, and letters are a brilliant resource for looking at family history. You know, so it enabled you to look at the kinds of roles, social roles that women played within the family and within society. Then I looked at marital correspondence as a separate chapter. And there's an awful lot of letters between husbands and wives. The final chapter looks at letters of petition. And this enabled me to look at the political role that women have. So, and I think having finished this, it meant that what I'd done was an enormous amount of archival research that then set up where I was going to go professionally afterwards. There was the work, and my work has been in several different directions. There's the work on women, which I, you know, and gender history, which I've been, you know, which I've been, has been a sort of real passion. There's been the strand on letter writing and later books on the culture of letter writing, and on the big book on the material letter. There's also been a strand on politics. I've been very interested in politics, and particularly how women fit into political structures. And then there's been a strand which is a more literary strand. You know, and I'm not just a historian, but I'm also I see myself as a sort of crossover literary critic as well. And so there's been, and also an interest in material texts. So looking at texts as physical objects and thinking about the sort of physical written forms of them, which has led into sort of later work on material culture and where I am now.
I think it's really, really good sort of establishing the firm foundations of how we write. I mean, now yes. I write very differently. So I've gone through, you know, a whole different kind of raft of books. I've written these illustrated ones. And then I did my Hearts of Oak trilogy.
Yeah.
The Fighting Temeraire, the story of the ship and the painting, Turner's famous painting, The Fighting Temeraire, the Admiral Benbow, who that's the name of the pub in Treasure Island, where Jim Hawkins meets Black Dog and Blind Pew, and Long John Silver. Anyway, the Admiral Benbow was a real person, and the Glorious First of June, which is this very important naval battle during the Reign of Terror, during the French Revolution, which has basically been forgotten, but it was considered to be the hardest fought battle of the Age of Sail. And we just run through the other books as well. I did a book called The In the Hour of Victory, which was about a collection of letters I found in a book in the British Library. You'd be really interested in that in terms of the actual how it works and what I discovered, the book as an object. That was the most important British naval dispatches for the that kind of glorious period of British naval power, 1794 to 1815. And then I wrote my biggest book, my last book, The Struggle for Sea Power, a huge naval history of the American Revolution. Very good. The point I want to make about this, we're not going to go through them one by one, but I've
interesting
got,
though that would be
all sorts of different versions of these books, and so each book has its own history. So let me just go and get this one.
Well, first of all, I'll give you this.
There we are. What's that?
Gosh, I have no idea. What, I don't even know what that is. It in Chinese?
It is. That's Fighting Ships in Chinese.
Goodness me.
So I've got different versions of these. So, wow. You know, each book has its own history. And this is probably one of the, well, this is the mid-range one. So you write the book, you hand it in, and then you get a bound draft of it. And this is an early version of it. So this is before the book is actually produced. You get sent a kind of an advanced reading copy, which you could then send out to people to review.
Yeah.
So it's printed on cheap paper. It hasn't got much of a cover. That's the earliest incarnation of a book.
Yes.
And then you have the hardback book. So we've got the hardback one of The Fighting Temeraire there. Then after that, it gets the paperback book. And then you can have different international copies of it. So I've got an American version of The Struggle for Sea Power there, and there's an English version. And so each book has its own version and its own life, which I think is interesting, and each book is slightly different. Yes. And just to finish off,
This is distinctly for trade press books, rather than academic books, which tend to come out in hardback.
I think this is the difference. We'll see. And this is my working copy of my book, In the Hour of Victory, which is about this amazing collection of British naval dispatches.
It's full of sticky notes with scrawls on them.
The spine's been ripped off. It's full of sticky notes.
It's a working copy,
and it's particularly a working copy for talks, for giving talks. So the sticky notes help me turn to things.
Great.
Immediately, which is particularly important for this kind of book, which is about letters, where you need to be...
Yes.
So I can talk off the top of my head about the context, but I can't memorise the letters.
No.
That really matters when you need to be so specific about it. So there you are. So those are all the different versions of my books. I think that the unexpected point there is that each one has its own history, which is different from... The history of me writing it, or as me as an author.
I want to take it in a slightly different direction. We've talked about the first book. We then talked about the range of historical fields and topics that I've worked on. And several things that I think are distinct and probably unexpected. One is I've written a lot with other people. Mm-hmm. And I've really enjoyed that. And we are writing together at the moment. And I think that whole process of writing with somebody else and producing a book with somebody else is really interesting. And I think I enjoy it more than writing by myself now, because I've learnt so much. I mean, I think the way it's always worked for me is... I think what you need to do is establish a structure that you're all happy with, and then you need to have your own independent tasks and sections that you're writing, and then be able to, so that you can go off and work independently, but then you need to come together and write. And I'd learned so much about writing in this way with a really, really good friend of mine, Andrew Gordon, who I've talked about quite a bit recently in these podcasts. And he is a brilliant prose stylist, wonderful, wonderful writer. And he's a literary critic as well. So he brings a sort of different, slightly different skill set to me. And just, I found working with him such a creative process. And we edited two books together, wrote, you know, large introductions together. And then I wrote with a professor in Sweden called Svante Norheim. And again, you know, this brilliant way. And now we are writing.
Yes. And I think so. The history of my books, the unexpected history of my books will be, this will be a significant moment, because the histories of the unexpected book I've written is the first book I've ever written with anyone else.
Yeah. It's good.
I'm really enjoying it.
And I think what I like about it is you've got a sort of sounding board.
Yeah.
You spring idea, you know, I find that kind of collaborative work, and I've done a lot of collaborative work over the last decade, that collaboration, which is really different from the lone historian working, you know, his or her kind of separate furrow. The joy about collaboration is the kind of, it's the spark, it's the excitement, it's the energy that comes from it.
Yeah. There we go. Even... our books have their own history. We've only just kind of touched on it, actually.
Yeah.
Because the other thing about it is that these books represent 15 years of work.
Yeah.
And so they're physically different.
Yes.
They've changed over time in terms of the way they're made, the way they look, the typeface, the letter, the paper they're printed on, everything. So they would actually open up a kind of a wonderful world of history about the history of the book.
Yeah. And the extraordinary thing that's happening at the moment is the print-on-demand books.
Yeah.
Have you come across those? I ordered something for our podcast the other day, a reader on material culture, and it came, and it was awful. It's like a sort of, it's printed on cheap A4 paper, and this is basically a book that is not A4. It's a book like the sort of standard size of a book.
Yeah.
But what they've done is they've basically done this print-on-demand, and the book is sort of in the middle of the page. So it's really awful to read.
Yeah.
And I think there is this move in publishing now to try and reduce costs, and the quality of book production is going downhill.
It's a particular problem with print on demand. That's by definition, you're asking for one copy.
Yeah.
And you know that's not the way publishers work. They need to be able to make 10,000 copies to actually make a beautiful book.
Yes.
And you know, also, I think an interesting point is my book, In the Hour of Victory. It's printed in black and red, and it's on beautiful thick paper. It's a very, very different physical kind of type of book. And that very much marks a point in the history of my books.
Yeah.
How they're made and why they're different. Thank you for listening, everyone. I thought that was very interesting.
I thought it was very interesting. We are very interesting. So.
If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on iTunes. Subscribe to the podcast and tell all of your friends, all of them. We're on Twitter. You can follow me at Dr. Sam Willis.
And you can follow me at James Daybell. And you can follow us at Unexpected Pod. We are desperately proud to be part of the excellent History Hit Network, home of Dan Snow's History Hit, and other great shows that you really should be listening to.
And you can find out more about what we've got planned in the forthcoming months, show notes, video clips, photos of everything, and all sorts of other stuff at historyhit.com/unexpected.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.